Good afternoon, and welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And all the information about our show, we used to have like a little sponsor spot right there, so now we're like, huh, what do we talk about now? we're shifting. So,
But you can be a sponsor.
Not to be confused with Shifty.
Yeah, we know who that is.
Yes, at wethepeopleradio.us, you have all of our contact information. We are happy for business sponsors, whether they want to be public or not. We kind of don't care. And individuals, we have a lot of individuals who sponsor the show. Great ways to do that. And I don't know, been on the air like 10 years this year in October.
I know.
Believe it or not. Who would have thought? Who would have thought all that time ago? We knew nothing about this, but see, we can't stop doing the show because then we wouldn't be able to talk to guests like Dr. Peter Pry. And our engineer today, Sue, is in there, and she's like, oh my gosh, I love this guy.
He's amazing.
He is amazing. And you said you had heard of him before, too.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's a chance to speak with people who are experts in their field, and I tell people, I learned so much stuff from the radio. So if you want to really learn a lot of things, do a talk radio show. Bring people on and then shut up.
And then, yeah, let the guests speak.
And then let them do all the talking. Yeah. So I won't do the whole bio. It's all on there. But Dr. Peter Vincent Pry has an extensive bio, and he's a very interesting man. He is the, executive director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, director of the U.S. Nuclear Strategy Forum. Both are congressional advisory boards, and served with the Congressional EMP Commission, which is kind of how we met him, and we wound up doing a show specifically on the electromagnetic pulse issue, and that was January 28th of 2018, and that link is there on our page for today. We're airing live today, May 19th, 2019, just in case we re-air this at a different time. But I would encourage you to go on there. It's listed commercial-free, and you'll be able to hear the whole show. So, fascinating. We've kind of diverted from the EMP issue, and we've gone into a bunch of other things. Where would you like to start this hour, Dr. Pry?
Well, I'd like to go back to that 30,000-foot level again.
All right.
And we can wrap up on EMP later if you like. But because part of the theme of the show has been to try to educate listeners on how dangerous the times are that we're living in. It's unprecedented in our history and in the memories of the professionals I work with in national security that this country has been so endangered. And basically we spent the first hour talking about how during the Cold War, you know, it was a bipolar world. And, you know, the pathway to nuclear conflict that we were worried about, you know, was from the Soviet Union. So we only had one pathway to worry about. But now we have at least three other actors, North Korea, China, and Russia. And so this is a threefold, possibly as great as a ninefold, greater risk of nuclear conflict. And we just wrapped up the last one saying that actually it might be fourfold, which would make because of Iran. Because Iran probably actually already has nuclear missiles, at least in my view and the view of many other experts. Although that isn't the Washington view and that isn't the official view of what is still the Obama administration's intelligence community. But I personally think that Iran does have the bomb. They've already got nuclear missiles, and they can probably make an EMP attack on the United States. So that would make it four actors that could bring a nuclear war to us, which means that the risk of nuclear war today compared to the Cold War is a 16-fold greater risk. If you're just doing it just purely by the numbers, just an obvious thing, just purely by the numbers and doing the standard kinds of calculations. But we also have additional factors that make this time more dangerous. I had talked about how the arms control process is deeply flawed, and the Russians have violated pretty much all the arms control treaties we have with them. That has enabled them to achieve, for the first time, superiority in the overall nuclear balance. You know, they've got a 10-to-1 advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. Right now, as we speak, they've got an advantage in intermediate-range nuclear weapons. because they violated the INF Treaty and have been violating it for years. And it's very possible that they've also violated the START Treaty. I would say it's likely they violated the START Treaty since they violated all the other treaties.
Exactly.
And have an advantage there that they've hidden from us. Sometimes it's so hard. Our people, you know, have such faith in these arms control treaties, such misguided faith, that they ignore obvious evidence of violations by the Russians, for example, that are right under your nose. You know, when we see their mobile ballistic missiles, their mobile ICBMs being paraded in Moscow, you don't actually see the missiles themselves because they're inside of a canister. It's called a cold launch canister. The way their missiles work, you know, is they use this canister. It's got compressed air in it, and it boosts the missile up before the engines launch. And the reason they do that is for the same reason we have cold launch canisters, for example, in our ballistic missile submarines, so that you use this highly compressed jet of air to blow the missile out of the tube before the engines ignite. That's because you don't want to damage the submarine. You don't, so that you can reload the launchers on the submarine later on and reuse those launchers. Well, that means that all these mobile missiles that we see and every missile that's in a cold launch canister, for some reason, they want to reload that launcher. So how can they be complying with the treaties if they've got reloads for all these things, right?
Right.
And how many reloads do they have? One, two, three? You know, we don't know. You know, we're not able to inspect that. But you'd think that would set alarm bells off all over the CIA and the State Department. But these are things you can just see on television.
But having them in those cold launch canisters also makes them much more mobile, doesn't it?
It does. It does. And it gives them greater throw weight, you know, because you're not using up rocket fuel to start, you know, to start that very heavy missile that's all loaded with fuel. You're giving it a head start, boosting it into the air before the engines ignite. So there's lots of advantages to using the cold launch canister. But the biggest advantage is that you can just pop another missile on there and reuse that launcher pretty quickly so that you can, so that a launcher could be used really an indefinite number of times. And you wouldn't go through the trouble of having that cold launch capability unless you did have reloads for those missile systems. Mm-hmm. So that's just another clear indicator. And this, to get away from the technical details, is another extremely dangerous circumstance that we never faced in the Cold War because we were rigorous during the Cold War. The reason we managed to prevent the Cold War from becoming a nuclear World War III is that we didn't let the Russians gain unilateral advantages. We competed with them, and we made sure that we balanced their tactical nuclear weapons with an equally formidable tactical nuclear weapon force ourselves. When they started deploying intermediate-range nuclear forces in Europe, Reagan started deploying intermediate-range forces in Europe. And we tried to make sure that they wouldn't have any technological or numerical, at least no big advantage, in the strategic nuclear balance, too, so that at every area they wouldn't be able to tell themselves, oh, we've got a war-winning edge now, so we're going to launch this nuclear World War III. That's what enabled us to win the Cold War. But we're not there now. We have enormous disadvantages in the nuclear balance, which is the most important part of the overall military balance. And it's a terrifying situation because this, again, is something that we've never faced during the Cold War. Another thing that makes it extremely disturbing is, the Russian economy is not strong. So we're starting to build up our forces again. It's going to take us a long time to catch up. You know, there's probably a window of vulnerability of almost a decade before we start compensating for these advantages that the Russians have. So what are they going to do? Are they going to let us catch up to them? Or are they going to, having invested so much in achieving this advantage, are they going to actually use it? They have been using it diplomatically with great success. This is why we didn't do anything, really, when they took Crimea, and it's why we haven't done anything over the long crucifixion of Ukraine. They've moved into the Middle East and basically replaced us as the do- dominant actor in the Middle East now. And, you know, they're able to get away with all these things because nuclear weapons, one of the advantages of them is they enable you to win competitions or wars or conflicts to achieve geostrategic goals without war, without their actual employment. And that's one of the biggest advantages. But at some point, you know, if they see us closing that gap, are they going to actually decide to employ them? Another area.
Hold that thought before we start that.
Certainly.
And we'll take a really quick break and come back with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. This could be the theme song for the whole thing.
Yeah, we're walking alone.
Down the lonely street of dreams. All right, Bill, you had a question.
Yeah, Dr. Pry, before we broke in the last break, you were talking about the advantage Russia has militarily and nuclearly on the nuclear side. But China's been very quiet. I mean, they've been playing the trade game and the intellectual property game, but what are they doing on the nuclear side of as far as their build up?
Well, it's always such a pleasure to interview with you guys because it's like you're reading my mind. I wanted to go to China.
Bill gets high points today.
every time we come back. Right. The standard view, the common wisdom in Washington and in the intelligence community, is that China's got about 380 nuclear weapons altogether, strategic and intermediate range nuclear weapons, you know, which is far less than what the United States has. But if you go back and you look at the estimates over time, if you believe that point of view, that's almost that they've always had about that many weapons. And they've never done anything to improve that number of weapons. And I just think this is just another example of our wishful thinking and burying our heads in the sand and not standing in the Chinese shoes and thinking strategically about, well, what would the Chinese do and how would they do it? I mean, I think it's obvious that the Chinese, you know, would try to conceal their nuclear strength. It's not in their interests for us to know just how strong they are. It's in their interest to know that they have enough to destroy a substantial fraction of the U.S. population for deterrence purposes.
Well, yeah, I mean, either side.
They don't really want us to know the full extent of their strength.
Sure.
And it took a professor at Georgetown University with some committed students to actually make a breakthrough, an intelligence breakthrough on this. We spend, you know, billions of dollars in the intelligence community, and nobody there seems to have noticed this thing called the Underground Great Wall. China's strategic rocket forces own this thing called the Underground Great Wall, which is a system of about 5,000 miles of underground tunnels that belongs to the Chinese strategic rocket forces.
Wow.
So what could be there? What do we suppose the Chinese strategic rocket forces are hiding from us?
They're hiding rice. They're storing rice.
Yes, exactly. I was going to say, it's probably not meals ready to eat. You know? Right.
They're coffee cookies.
You know, and they did some calculations in Georgetown on the on what you could how much floor space you'd need, you know, to have mobile missiles and things of that sort. And they calculate that the Chinese strategic rocket forces could hide at least 3,000 ICBM class missiles in the underground Great Wall, which would give them twice as many strategic long range warheads as we have under the New START treaty. And I think that analysis is probably far closer to the truth than what the State Department wants.
380.
Everybody believe. And I also think it's no accident that the Chinese have no interest in joining the New START treaty. When Pompeo met with Lavrov, the Russian Minister of Foreign Affairs, to talk about, well, should we extend the New START treaty? And Pompeo said, well, if we do that, we want to bring China into the picture. China immediately said they don't want to have any part of the New START treaty. Well, if they've only got 380 warheads, and we've been right about how limited their nuclear arsenal is all these years, why shouldn't they want to become part of the New START and let us have inspectors go over there and prove that that's all that they've got? You know, it's just extremely suspicious. They've clearly had the military, industrial, and nuclear capabilities to build a much bigger arsenal over the years than what has been attributed to them. And the kinds of missiles they're getting are very sophisticated. They've got a mobile ICBM, for example, China, that has got 10 warheads, 10 high-yield, very accurate warheads. It's similar to a mobile version of the Russian SS-18, which is the... It used to be the only heavy ICBM in the world. Under the SALT treaties, they were permitted this advantage in terms of having a heavy ICBM. This is an ICBM that has much greater throw weight than any other U.S. missile, so it can carry basically these 10 very high-yield, highly accurate warheads. It's a first-strike weapon. That's its really only purpose.
Sure.
It's designed to go after our hard targets, like our Minuteman silos or command and control bunkers. It really has no other purpose but a first strike. And China has got a missile that looks a lot like the SS-18, except it also has the advantage of being mobile, so that they can hide it. You know, the SS-18, the Russians, their SS-18, or it's also called the Satan, is located in a silo, which also means that makes it even more likely for a first strike weapon. So that China... It doesn't make a lot of sense to be developing small numbers of highly sophisticated strategic and intermediate-range nuclear missiles, because that drives up the cost of each unit tremendously. Mm-hmm. We know that from our own experience, you know. You don't buy 10 F-15s, you buy hundreds of F-15s, because the cost of building 10 F-15s is astronomical compared to the benefit you get from buying large numbers of them. And this same economic logic applies to nuclear missiles and as well. So just from a cost-effectiveness economic standpoint, not to mention the strategic advantages you get, it just doesn't make sense that the Chinese, you know, would make such tremendous investments to have such small numbers of nuclear weapons.
Well, one of the things that, I don't know, I always think about when they talk about nuclear first strike capability is, how many of these warheads would it take to totally dismember either country? I mean, I would think that if you put 10 or 15 of them out at one time in strategic areas in the country, it's pretty much game over at that point. And to have thousands of them, it's kind of overkill, but I guess you figure not all of them are going to get through, but I mean, how many would it take?
It wouldn't take very many. You know, that's another thing that has happened since the end of the Cold War, in terms of a lot, the decline of our strategic posture. You know, during the Cold War, we had, which we have to keep in mind, that we won the Cold War, okay? We won the Cold War. So it might be, it might have made sense, I would have said that it should have made sense, that having won the Cold War, we probably never should have reduced our posture, because we knew that was a winning ticket,
sure,
the kinds of forces we had deployed during the Cold War. But we didn't do that. Instead, we allowed our forces to deteriorate, so that during the Cold War, for example, we had 45 strategic bomber bases, and on those strategic bomber bases, you know, we had bombers on strip alert, so they were ready to take off just in case a surprise attack happened. We now have 3 strategic bomber bases. We've gone from 45 to 3 strategic bomber bases, and the bombers are not, there are no bombers on strip alert, none. So even North Korea could wipe out one entire leg of our strategic triad, the bomber force, with just 3 warheads. We only have 2 ballistic missile submarine bases. And it used to be in the Cold War that we had enough ballistic missile submarines so that we had, you know, more than a dozen of them at sea. More than a dozen at sea, okay? We had about 45 to 50 ballistic missile submarines, because about two-thirds of them have to remain in port, and then one-third in order to sustain one-third at sea. You know, our ballistic missile submarine fleet has fallen from 45 to 50 during the Cold War to 14. We've got 14 Ohio-class ballistic missile submarines now, and it's going to go down to 12 when we have the Columbias, just 12. You know, that means that we'll only be able to have 4 ballistic missile submarines at sea, 4 ballistic missile submarines at sea. And the others, 8, will be in those 2 ballistic missile, in those 2 ports. So with 2 warheads, you could take out, on a surprise attack, you could take out two-thirds of the ballistic missile submarine fleet. So that's five warheads to destroy most of the triad. Most of the submarines, all of the bombers, would have 4 of the submarines at sea. We had over 1,000 ICBMs during the Cold War, the land-based intercontinental ballistic missiles. It's now down to 400.
Oh.
During the Cold War, all of our ICBMs, most of our ICBMs, had 3 warheads. We've deloaded, we've taken warheads off the Minuteman so that every Minuteman only has 1 warhead now. You know, so that greatly reduces that deterrent capability. Basically, you know, what it comes down to is if the Russians, if you had an SS-18 class ICBM, and if you launched 50 of them, that's enough warheads, 500 warheads. That's more than enough warheads to take out all of our ICBMs, all the bomber bases, the 2 ballistic missile submarine bases, and to also hit all of our command and control. That's enough for a disarming strike. You're not attacking the cities in this. It's a counterforce attack. It's a disarming first strike.
Right.
And with the modern technologies that the Russians are getting, I've described kind of a Cold War type attack, but one of the reasons the Pentagon finds these hypersonic weapons so threatening is they can fly under our radar, so you can't see them coming, and they can maneuver. That means that not only is it very hard to shoot them down with ballistic missile defenses, in fact, it would be impossible to shoot down a strategic missile because our national missile defense isn't designed.
You wouldn't even know they were there.
Yeah, it is, and they aren't designed. Yeah. They were. It's real. What we've got is a Clinton administration version of national missile defense. It was designed for North Korea, and it's not even good against North Korea because the North Korean missiles are a lot more advanced than we thought that they would be. That's because they've been getting help from the Russians and the Chinese in building their missiles.
So wasting the last 2 years on Russia. It turns out we should have been doing a few other things.
Yes,
we have to take a really quick break here with our guest, Dr. Peter Pry, and we'll be right back. Here's a little song for all those people who don't tell us the truth. The fully cheerful song. Good pick, Sue. Couldn't resist that one. That was a good one. All right, Dr. Pry. Yes.
Your musical selections are so appropriate.
I have a really good one for you for the next break. I was just listening to it during the commercial because I'm thinking you probably don't have enough fun.
Well, that's probably true. I'm sure that is true.
I'm queuing up a little CIA fun for you, if that maybe you could use it, you know, in one of your hearings or something.
Well, thank you so much.
Sure.
The closest thing I have to fun is these radio conversations. I find them therapeutic.
You have chosen the right people.
Send me a bill for your psychiatric services while I expound my frustration.
It's your time to get it off your chest. We'll give you that.
But since we're in the last half hour, you know, maybe it's time for us to talk about some good news and try to end on an up note on this, because there is definitely the possibility of light at the end of this tunnel. And I think you had mentioned at the beginning of the show that you had me on in January 2018, and we focused on electromagnetic pulse, the EMP threat, and now, more than a year later. Those who may remember that broadcast might be interested to know that President Trump has acted on the EMP threat. And on the 26th of March, he fought the first president to sign an executive order to try to protect our electronic civilization from both nuclear and natural EMP, and not just the electric grid, but all the critical infrastructures. Our president deserves tremendous credit for writing an executive order that basically tries to implement all the key provisions of that the Congressional EMP Commission had recommended. And in fact, my book EMP Manhattan Project, it even seems to use that as a blueprint, because the project to protect our nation from EMP is not going to be run out of the Department of Homeland Security or the Department of Energy or the Department of Defense, but it's going to be run out of the White House. The White House itself is taking charge, just the way that General Leslie Groves was given almost dictatorial powers and basically was the tool of the White House to get the country to build the first atomic bombs. A similar crash emergency program is intended by this executive order. So that's extremely good news.
Mm-hmm. That's great.
It would take one of the greatest threats to our civilization off the table and correct that. And we have I remember when I briefed, it wasn't President Trump at the time, but he was candidate Trump, when he was first running for office at the Iowa caucuses, I had 45 minutes to brief him on the EMP threat. He had never heard of it before, but he's a smart guy, contrary to what the press would have you believe. He understood it. He picked up on it. And I'd explained to him, he wanted to know, well, why is it that here we face an existential threat from electromagnetic pulse? How come the U.S. government has failed to do anything? And I explained that one of the fundamental problems was the buck passing that goes on between these departments and agencies. You know, the Department of Defense says an EMP could come from the sun, and therefore it doesn't belong to them. It belongs to the Department of Homeland Security. The Department of Homeland Security says, well, an EMP can be from a nuclear weapon. Therefore, it really is the Department of Defense's job to protect against this. And the guys over at the Department of Energy, who have too cozy a relationship with the electric utilities, say, hey, this is a national security problem. This isn't a problem for the private sector that owns the utilities that are going to be destroyed. You know, this belongs to either DOD or DHS, not us. Not us at DOE and the utilities. And that's the reason. That was one of the fundamental reasons. And the president, what President Trump said to me after hearing that was, don't worry, when I'm elected president, we'll knock their heads together and get this problem fixed. Mm-hmm. And then he walked out the door. And basically, he's keeping his promise in his executive order, because that's exactly what his executive order does. It uses more bureaucratic language, but in effect, what he's doing in his executive order is knocking together the heads of all these departments and agencies, saying, hey, you all have a piece of this problem. You're all responsible for it. I'm not going to trust any of you to get the problem fixed, because you've had years to do it and haven't done anything. We're going to be running this thing out of the White House. year from now, that is next March 26th, 1 year from now, you are going to deliver into my hands certain tools that I need and certain information that I need so that we can hit the ground running and finally get the country protected on an emergency basis from EMP. So it's an excellent executive order. It's some good news that we can all take home from this, up to this point, very depressing conversation, you know, that at least we have finally have a president of the United States and an official executive order that's going to try to ramrod through this protection. That doesn't mean it's actually going to happen. You know, President Trump still has to fight the deep state. They're going to do everything they can to delay and do nothing, and the electric power industry is doing this. One of the articles I had submitted to you is about, for example, the Electric Power Research Institute, you know, which pretends to be an objective scientific body, but they're really bought and paid for by the electric power industry. They're a lobby for the electric power industry. They put out a report trying to say, oh, look, the EMP threat isn't all that bad. It's been overstated. Trust us in the electric utilities. We know all about this. We'll fix the problem. You know, we don't need federal regulation or anything like that. You know, that's but the same thing they've been saying for years. They can't be trusted. They don't know any. Their own report, you know, shows they don't really understand the EMP threat at all. It's a junk science study, not a serious study. But it's an example of the kind of obstructionism that's going to be cast in the president's way. But I think, you know, he'll bulldoze. Hopefully he'll bulldoze through it. I'm hoping he'll say you're fired to people within his own government that he needs to say it to get them out of the way. The other very positive development, of course, is the U.S. Space Force. I think the vision that President Trump had for the U.S. Space Force is that it would be the embodiment of a continuation, a fulfillment of Ronald Reagan's vision with the Strategic Defense Initiative that was stupidly derided by the press as Star Wars. I don't mind calling it Star Wars. It should be a badge of honor. And even though it was intended as a kind of ridicule, in a way, it's a positive way of describing the Strategic Defense Initiative, because it means carrying our national defense and the defense of our allies to the high frontier of outer space. Yes, call it Star Wars. It's defending us, you know, from these nuclear missiles, you know, in space among the stars, as it were. And the phrase conveys the kind of revolutionary military development that this, in fact, is. You know, it's not a small thing. And I hope that there's bureaucratic opposition there too. I mean, the U.S. Air Force wants to limit it to new sensors in space and things of that sort. So does the State Department and the arms control community. But what this thing really should be about is putting up the kinds of technologies that were born out of President Reagan's Strategic Defense Initiative. A friend of mine, Ambassador Henry Cooper, who had been the director of the Strategic Defense Initiative, for example, had developed a system called Brilliant Pebbles. It was ready to go during the Clinton administration, ready to go, but because it would have required the United States to withdraw from the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, and we have talked at length about how fond the State Department and Washington is of arms control treaties and how reluctant we are ever to withdraw from them, even if it serves our national interest, the Clinton administration canceled Brilliant Pebbles and canceled the Strategic Defense Initiative and instead gave us ground-based missile defense, which is the worst kind of missile defense. It's the least effective missile defense. That's why the national missile defense doesn't work very well. You know, it's basically, you can thank Bill Clinton for the national missile defense that we have today. If we had deployed Brilliant Pebbles back in the Clinton administration, it would have had a profound change in our strategic situation. All these threats we've been talking about today could be neutralized by space-based defenses, by a space-based shield.
And we had it all that time ago.
Well, yeah. That's a big part of why Russia came to the bargaining table, because they couldn't confirm or deny we had that. I mean, that was...
Exactly. They didn't want their incredible investment in offensive weapons to be canceled by the deployment of Star Wars, quote-unquote. It was a major contributing factor, and the Russians themselves admit this, to our victory in the Cold War.
All right, we're going to take a quick break, last break of the hour here.
Here's your fun song. There's actually three parts to it, but we'll display the first one. You can enjoy it for the your CIA stuff. We're on with Dr. Peter Pry.
Recently with a plain and simple dream. Wanna infiltrate some third world place and topple their regime. Those men in black with their matching suitcases, where everything's on a need-to-know basis. Agents got that swagger, everyone's so cloak and dagger. I'm feeling nervous, but I'm really kinda wishing for an undercover mission. That's when the red alert came on the radio, and I put my earpiece on. Got my dark sunglasses on, and I had my weapon drawn. So I get my handcuffs, my cyanide pills, my classified dossier. Tapping the phones like, shredding the files like, I memorized all the enemy spies. I gotta neutralize today. Yeah, it's a party in the CIA. Yeah, it's a party in the CIA.
Stop me now.
I'm having such a good time. I'm having a ball.
Fitting way to end.
Yeah. I'm sorry, we don't have another hour.
I'm sorry, we don't have another hour, too.
Well, that's probably a good thing. Otherwise, I'd get people depressed again.
No, well, but you know what? Honestly, people are given so much. You look at what passes for news in large part. It's not news. It's the same stuff over and over. It's basically like junior high. It's a bunch of people who pass notes and don't like each other, and you know that kind of, okay, I do enjoy the name calling. I'm not going to denigrate that. That part is fun. Sleepy Joe and all that. I do enjoy that, but it is very juvenile. And this information, although it could be classified as depressing, is actually real.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things you know that concerns me and. And I hope I don't break my promise to try to end on a positive note here by saying this.
It's okay.
All of these foreign threats we've been discussing, and there is a light at the end. There is the possibility of countering them by these initiatives, by EMP protection, and by the U.S. Space Force that we had discussed. But that last song you had played, that song about the shredding going on at the CIA and everything, one of the things that really does worry me is, you know, the growth of the administrative state, the national security state, in itself becoming a threat to our freedom, as we've nearly witnessed. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you really think about that attempted coup d'etat, because that's what it was.
Absolutely.
Attempted coup d'etat, right? If Hillary had won, look how close she came to winning. If she had won, we would have never known about it, and we'd have lost our constitutional republic.
Yep. They were counting on the fact that no one ever learned about it.
And probably never gave it a second thought.
And what you were saying about how the news is so juvenile, and you're right. You know, we tend to think of Americans in the 19th century and in the 18th century, the founders and the people that came after them, as unsophisticated and illiterate and everything. You know, people actually got their public entertainment from politics. They were a lot more politically literate and understood the issues a lot better than we do today. You know, if you think about political debates, people would go to political debates that would go on for hours, and the issues would be, and the philosophical stakes would be discussed at great depth, except for radio shows like yours, you know, where we could dedicate 2 hours to talking about these sorts of things. You're absolutely right. Most of it is, you know, you can't understand these issues in a 1 minute sound bite.
No.
You know, people are simply really not informed. And how are we to be a free people? I mean, that's foundational to being a free society, for people to be informed, to understand, so that they can make the correct decisions. You know, that's just very worrisome, so that even if we are not defeated by Russia or China or destroyed by North Korea or Iran, will we escape the fate of most constitutional republics? Because in the long history of mankind, men have not lived primarily under free societies. You know, societies like ours are rare and miraculous in the history of the human condition.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you can lose it in one generation. We almost did in this last presidential election.
Yeah, and when you look at how long we've been here, it's the blink of an eye compared
to
some
things,
of the,
all things considered.
You know, when you look at some of these other civilizations that have reigned.
Well, you look at what's happening. You have, well, the left used to be all about free speech and big government was bad and all those things. And you look at the tremendous shift that has gone on there. And now it's all about we need more government.
It's a total socialist.
I've had people say, well, I get a lot of robocalls. The federal government needs to rein that in. I'm like, you know, you might want to think that through. Do you really want the federal government screening all of your calls? I mean, I get that the robocalls are annoying or the telemarketers and stuff, but you want the federal government to screen every phone call?
And just the fact that one of our major political parties is fundamentally openly embracing socialism.
That's
confusing as hell.
Yeah, I mean, it shows the lack of education even among the political leadership of a major party that is antithetical to being a free society. Every socialist society, you know, ends up becoming an authoritarian or totalitarian state. You know, they promise a worker's paradise, and it always ends up with a holocaust and concentration camps.
Without exception.
Or Venezuela is obviously a terrific example. But see, then they turn around and they say, but if we just did it different, like, really?
Yeah.
Yeah, just a little.
I know.
Different rollout of socialism will have a different outcome. Oh, wait, no.
That's right. It's you know, human nature doesn't change. And, you know, and the greed for power doesn't change. You know, you can't entrust, you know, a small elite. We don't even like this, the way our present society has become, where we've got a Washington elite, you know, that has so much power and so much wealth concentrated in its hands. Most Americans, at least intuitively, understand that that's not a healthy condition. But you're going to get that in spades if you become a socialist society. It's going to concentrate even more power in the hands of Washington. And as Jefferson said, you cannot grow government power. That comes at the expense of freedom. It comes at the expense of freedom. And as Franklin said, you know, those who would trade freedom for security.
Yep, we'll have neither.
And we'll end up with neither, and deserve neither.
Well, it's interesting because if people don't, a really good example, I think, in our government, people think, you know, the Forest Service. For instance, we live in an area that is heavily forested. The county to the north of us is like 62%, I think, public land. So people look at the Forest Service and they're like, those guys are everywhere. You know, you got these rangers all over us and they've got police and, you know, you can't do anything anymore and they're closing the roads and they have 30,000 employees. So when you go to make changes, that's a heavy lift. But then let's look at where I think most Americans would agree we need a lot of change, and that would be the VA. They have 360,000 employees. Now go try to fix it. So, I mean, we know what it looks like. I just don't think we're always educated on the factual picture. And the bigger it gets, the less likely it is to get fixed because it's just too darn big.
Yeah, and we also have the problem of our universities,
well,
you know, being hot propaganda hotbeds that actually dumb down our youth. You know, they don't really teach history anymore. They certainly don't teach a positive version of American history.
Right.
America is portrayed as the great villain in world history, and so they're willing to cast aside our historical past. That's what all the tearing down of statues is about. Not just Confederate statues, but Thomas Jefferson and George Washington, controversies being raised about them because they were slave owners.
Well, and interestingly enough, we learned from a Chinese dissident who's been on the show a couple times, and June told us that one of the tenets of communism is that all the artwork has to be ugly, formless, and shapeless. because anything that represents ideals lifts the human spirit, and you're not allowed to have any of that.
Yeah. I'm glad you brought that up.
Oh, yeah, that makes sense. Of
Dr.
All the
Pry, because it's
bank art.
Our universities, I think, are so important. I mean, they're churning out our future leaders, and they're coming out of these universities with this socialist idea in their head, and that has to change, or we are going to be in serious. We're already in trouble, but I mean,
we have a lot of people who aren't students. I don't know if people realize how many folks in their, you know, 70s and 80s think socialism's okay. I think it gets relegated to the youth.
Yeah, I don't.
But
I don't
it's
know how that's what's happening because it, that's
well,
what they're
children
teaching
of the 60s.
Well, and the kids coming out of college, this is what they're being taught, and so they get out in the real world and they try to implement it, and it doesn't work so well.
Yeah.
You know, the first paycheck is they look at their...
Who's FICA and how did they get all my money?
Exactly. You know, they have not a clue how economics works and how our government works, and because they're not teaching that. So.
No, in fact, it's getting... Sort of the canary in the cage, you know, is about...
And fair warning, we're down to like the last 45 seconds here, so...
Okay.
We are literally running out the clock, but we still have 40 seconds, so yeah, fire away.
Fundamentals of science, all right?
Oh,
you know,
yes.
Do you want to be led by a political party that believes that there are 32 genders and not two biological sexes?
Oh,
just think about that.
Goodness, we got that in there, because you know what? That is ludicrous.
Thanks for coming on, Dr. Pry.
We really appreciate having
you
on.
Thank you so much.
We have just spent the last 2 hours with Dr. Peter Pry. I hope you will visit our website and get all of his information. He's written a bunch of really super good books. He always has good articles on. I hope he'll come back with us. So you're listening to
My pleasure. Thank you for both of you for becoming part of the solution.
Absolutely. We're just thrilled to have you as our guest again. Catch us next week, and you can find everything online at WeThePeopleRadio.us.